Well, I'll just start out with saying I'm really honored that you guys would have me up here tonight to speak to you. Not that you really had a choice, but thanks for not leaving at the coffee break. I've been on the stage a lot over the years, but never like this, so just thank you for listening tonight. I'm hoping tonight to give some personal insights on the Advent theme of love. And at first I was thinking about this and thinking that love seemed like almost too vague of a topic to talk about. Its ubiquity makes it somewhat meaningless, I think. And, you know, we all know what it is, and we use the word to mean a thousand different things. But we also understand that it's mysterious and that we don't really know what love, how to define that exactly. But here we are, and here I am thinking about love, God's love, at Christmas. My brother Daniel and Sophia and I are singing a song together tomorrow night at the 11 o'clock service, and the chorus says this: I think I can hear the angels sing, there has come a child and a king, peace upon the earth, because he will bring love for all of our tired, cold hearts. So this song has been in my head and on in the background as I've been doing my reading to prepare for tonight. And so this idea keeps coming back to me, love for all. Let's start out tonight by opening to Isaiah 42, which is on page 1089 in the fancy new Bibles. We'll read verses 1 through 7. And this passage is one of many in Isaiah prophesying about the coming of Christ and explaining what kind of kingdom he's bringing. And we'll have it up on the slides as well, if you could just throw that up there. Look at my servant whom I strengthen. He is my chosen one who pleases me. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or raise his voice in public. He will not crush the weakest reed or put out a flickering candle. He will bring justice to all who have been wronged. He will not falter or lose heart until justice prevails throughout the earth. Even distant lands beyond the sea will wait for his instruction. God the Lord created the heavens and stretched them out. He created the earth and everything in it. He gives breath to everyone, life to everyone who walks on the earth. And it is he who says, I, the Lord, have called you to demonstrate my righteousness. I will take you by the hand and guard you, and I will give you to my people Israel as a symbol of my covenant with them. And you will be a light to guide the nations. You will open the eyes of the blind. You will free the captives from prison, releasing those who sit in dark dungeons. Let's just pray. God, I just ask that you would make our hearts soft. Give us your grace. And give me grace tonight as I attempt to bring your word this evening. I ask that you bring us from wherever we've been this week, in our own context, both personal but also as a community, at this time in history, in this place tonight. Help us to hear what it is you have to say to us. Amen. I really like this little series that Rob's been doing. I loved hearing Adam, the physicist, talk about entropy and the hope of creation, and hearing Dana, who works with refugee families, talk about internal and external peace. And I've been wondering what perspective I could bring on this broad topic of love. I just graduated this past spring with a degree in political studies and a history minor, and now I'm working in electoral politics and trying to devote some of my spare time to social justice issues. So my perspective on love tonight is coming from this political angle, which colors my reading of the Bible and my interpretation of Jesus' message. And also, this is the first thing I've ever written since school ended, so I'm sorry if this sounds like an essay. I'm trying to keep it unacademic, if you will. So what I want to talk about tonight is the example of love shown to us in Jesus' ministry in the Gospels, taking a political perspective to see how it challenged exclusive systems that kept people outside of God's plan of justice, restoration, and salvation. And it's a topic that's close to my heart for a number of reasons. Most of you know me pretty well. I grew up in a Christian family, and my dad was a pastor here for a long time of the morning services, and I think I made it out of the Christian upbringing fairly unscathed. I brought that sort of foundational faith that I was given into my adulthood, and have since had that sort of coming-of-age problem that a lot of you are familiar with, where you try to understand the world without letting go of all your Sunday school answers for things. And I think I've been trying to do that for a while, and letting go of some of those answers and rewording others, and just trying to figure out what I actually believe about all of this stuff. And the toughest thing for me, I think, has been figuring out how my faith implicates other people around the world and other people in my life, and particularly those closest to me who I really love but maybe don't fit into that kind of Sunday school framework that I've been working with. So this message on love tonight is somewhat confessional, I suppose. It's sort of what this wrestling has left me with so far and sort of what I'm still trying to figure out. And I'm no theologian, so most of the biblical ideas tonight and the examples that I'll be giving are from this book that I've been reading called Binding the Strong Man. Beth gave it to me. It's the political reading. Oh, Brendan's excited. I'm about halfway through. Okay, I've got Brendan's approval. I can chill. Okay, so the political, it's a political reading of Mark's story of Jesus by Ched Myers. And Myers takes on, he takes on Mark with this socio-literary understanding or interpretation, which means that not unlike the humanities in a history, English, or political studies class, Myers is looking not only at what's being said in this gospel, but how it's being said and what those implications are for the society that first heard them, Mark's audience, but also how we hear it as kind of a modern audience. So maybe it's because this format is something I'm sort of familiar with from school, but this book has really helped me articulate my own struggles in combining the political and the religious. And here I use the term political to mean a whole range of relationships, economic, governmental, cultural, in a given group of people, be that like a household, a village, a classroom, a country, or a set of countries. Throughout my political studies, my personal belief in God and understanding of his kingdom never conflicted with the way I understood geopolitics or, you know, social justice issues. That all seemed like one story to me. But in general, there's a distinction between the religious and the rest of life. And it's a distinction that Myers refuses to make. He uses political and theological discourses interchangeably. And it's sort of a freedom that I've taken in kind of my own worldview and the way I talk about both the Bible and politics. But that combination of the religious and the social, of the church and the state, is tricky, and it makes people nervous. So I'm just going to quickly talk about it so you guys can relax a little bit. Analyzing biblical texts with a political perspective requires what Myers calls hermeneutical honesty. And we call, in political studies, we call that the situated voice, which basically means that you have to recognize that there's no such thing as an objective reading of anything, that you're always bringing yourself into the equation, and with that, like a wonderful set of nuances. So if anything I say tonight sounds biased, it probably is. And so is any reading of the Bible, actually. But the way we can all get around this is by stating that perspective up front and being open about our preconceptions and our biases so they can be seen and critiqued not only by each other, but also by the gospel itself. So I'm hoping to do that tonight. And I think the real reason why we hesitate to bring the political and the theological together in our context is because we're not really prepared for the implications. It's difficult to read the social, not merely the metaphysical or spiritual agenda of Jesus, without identifying more with those that Jesus opposed throughout his ministry. At least I find that. And to explain this, I'm going to give you a quick little political studies lesson in critical theory, but there's going to be a little bit of PowerPoint, so I think you'll be able to follow along. And I hope you had a bit of coffee to keep you awake, because I think this stuff is really awesome, and it's helped me understand the world, and also the Gospels. So you can throw the first slide up there, Joel. The concept is found in postmodern theory, and it's called deconstructionism. And this is the premise that we understand the world in codes, and that those codes are organized in a hierarchy. And in political studies, we call these binaries, where there's a dominant thing. You can go to the next slide. There's a dominant thing, and then it's other, or it's peripheral. And we encounter these all the time. So these are just some examples from a textbook that I had. But in gender terms, so a patriarchal society would have man as sort of the dominant and then woman as the other. In geopolitical terms, you know, Western capitalist nations might be the center, and those economically dependent on them would be the periphery. In the context of the gospel, the Roman Empire was the governmental center, and then those colonized were the others. And in their own Hebrew communities, the scribal authority and the religious elite were the center, and those outside their standards of purity would be considered peripheral. In my reading of the Gospels, I've noticed that Jesus seems to be primarily focused on those in the peripheries, and we talk about that a lot here. He's always with the others, and he's constantly challenging the center or those who held power over the peripheries. So the Gospel is rooted in the peripheries, and yet we are reading it from the center, from what Myers calls the locus imperium, the empire. Most of us are white North American Christians, some even from a privileged strata of society. And this is problematic, and I think it makes it difficult to really understand God's love. And I don't think that it's that God automatically opposes people with power, but rather that because being dominant and being in the center is inherently vulnerable, it's an exclusive position. We can't all be on top. Derrida, the guy who came up with this sort of term deconstructionism, he's a French philosopher, and he argues that because the center is vulnerable, you have to justify that position by dehumanizing other people, and you have to either exclude them or oppress them or ignore them or marginalize the periphery, and it's that process that seems so offensive to God as I read through the Gospels. So deconstruction, then, is a way of analyzing or understanding these binaries in a subversive way, by turning them on their heads. And you can go to the next slide. The Beatitudes are just a perfect example of this. Simply by accepting or demonstrating that there's this other way, this kind of upside-down kingdom, we've deconstructed the center. So those are just the first couple of Beatitudes. Go to the next slide, that's fine. But subverting the exclusive center is threatening to those who benefit from being there, and is therefore a political practice. And it's one that Jesus engaged in constantly. Now, Derrida was not talking about Jesus, and he might not be too impressed that I'm appropriating his theory for this context, but in my reading of the Bible, this process of deconstruction is exactly what Jesus seems to be doing all the time. And it gets him in a lot of trouble. He's socially ostracized, a political rebel, and a radical in his own day. But this process was, in my mind, one of the most tangible examples of the love that he came to bring us. I want to give you a few examples of this from the book of Mark, based on the Myers commentary, to connect this idea of Jesus and deconstructionism. And I just want to encourage you to be mindful of who you sort of identify with in these gospel accounts. And also to try to keep your mind on that Isaiah passage that I opened tonight with, because I'll be coming back to that at the end. I apologize for straying away from the Christmas story. I'm going to be talking about the Gospels, and I think we'll get a lot of the Christmas story in the services tomorrow night. But Mark was really closely connected to Isaiah. He quotes him a lot, beginning right from chapter 1, and I think he really saw the Jesus that Isaiah was talking about. The one, especially in this passage that we just read, the Jesus that was prophesied about and whose birth we'll be celebrating this week. So Mark starts out his description of Jesus' mission with a handful of episodes of healing and exorcism, casting out of demons. And when Jesus was doing these acts, he really upset the local religious authorities, and it immediately put him in the position of a political radical. And at first glance, that's sort of confusing. I had never really thought about it before, but why would, you know, the religious leaders be so offended that Jesus was helping people in these mere acts of compassion? And reading through this book and kind of dealing with some of these questions, it's clear that Jesus' healing ministry expressed a love beyond mere compassion and care. Not that those aren't important, but his love was making a really political statement. The first thing that's obvious is that his healing ministry was most often among the peripheries, especially among the poor. Not unlike our own society, disease and sickness is concentrated, in impoverished communities. people who dealt with unstable employment, with poor housing, inconsistent access to food or markets, the widows, the orphans, refugees, migrant laborers. These are people without a lot of power into society, and they tend to get sick more often than the rest of us. And this was true back then. This is a cycle of poverty. And these are the people who sought Jesus out and who saw hope in him where they didn't see hope in other sources of power or sources of support, I guess. And this is because Jesus wasn't just curing poor people of their physical ailments. If we see Jesus' miracles only from a biomedical perspective, just the medicine that he was offering them, in a sense, we're focusing only focusing on what was wrong with their bodies and their minds, we're missing the political aspect of Jesus' ministry. The poorest peasants of Jesus' day didn't know about diseases. They knew about illness. And illness is socially defined. And it's defined by society and not a doctor. It was a disadvantaged state that included physical symptoms, but also exclusion from society, little means of making money, and also proof of spiritual shortcoming. Illness was associated with impurity or sin, and it was a state that meant exclusion from full status in the social fabric. Jesus did not cure those he came in contact with. He healed them. He restored the social wholeness that sick people were denied by the dominant order of Hebrew society. Jesus' love subverted a system of exclusion that society used to decide who was good and bad, who was pure and who was impure, who was in and who was out, both socially and spiritually. So reading this in 2012, with our knowledge of medicine and its limits, we're tempted to dwell upon the amazing impossibility of these miracles, the manipulation over the natural. But the readers of Mark's gospel would have seen this as just one part of Jesus' loving act. The Hebrew people understood at a cultural level that Yahweh had control over the natural world. It was under his dominion, like when Moses parted the Red Sea. What was really incredible to them was Jesus' challenge to a social and political system that played by a completely different set of rules. Jesus' healing and exorcism opened up the center of healthy, engaged, and pure people by showing how that system legitimized exclusion of the poor. And that is why his miracles were not universally embraced. Depending on your status in that center-periphery relationship, you would see Jesus' miracles as either heretical or as a source of freedom. Jesus' great love sets us free, bringing justice to the poor and those who are on the peripheries of society. And this goes even further in the next story in Mark, the story of the healing of the paralytic, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, where a lame man is brought to Jesus in front of a large crowd, including the religious leaders. And before healing him, Jesus says, "Your sins are forgiven." And the religious elite who witnessed this declared Jesus to be a blasphemer, but Jesus goes on to heal him, telling him to get up and walk. So here the poverty, sickness, impurity cycle is explicitly broken, with Jesus getting to the root of the man's problems, that he is apparently sick because he has sinned in some unforgivable way. By offering the forgiveness of sins, Jesus is subverting the central powers of the religious elite. They justified their position in society by being the best, by being morally superior. And they held that over the heads of those of others, and it was their main source of power. When Jesus threatened to take that away, he was immediately accused of blaspheming, which is the harshest accusation that the religious leaders could throw at him. But I don't think they were angry that he was forgiving people's sins in God's place. I think they were angry because he was forgiving people's sins in their place. They had been exercising that right exclusively for some time, and Jesus was challenging their authority over the debt code, as Myers puts it, and it's basically the naughty and nice list, if you will, that ordered Jewish social systems. And this was a highly political act of love. Jesus not only cured the man's body, but openly released him from any sins that were perceived to have caused his illness in the first place, restoring his dignity, his place in society, and wiping the slate clean. Jesus' great love releases us from the claims of others that say that we're not forgiven, making us whole and restoring our humanity. And one final example I want to give comes next in Mark, which shows an even further extension of Jesus' radical inclusion. His table fellowship with Levi, the tax collector. Levi represents a group that wasn't poor, but was socially ostracized in every other way. Their lifestyle legitimized disapproval from the religious leaders and most people in society, to the point of denying them basic civil rights. Jesus deconstructs this through table fellowship with the other. Again, to fully understand the political implications of this choice, it's important to recognize the context and realize just how seriously the Pharisees took this kind of action. They had very strict rules around table fellowship, even comparing the relative leniency or strictness of the different Pharisaic houses as to who they would associate with in that sort of formal of a way. And this was a central part of the holiness code they had, sort of the opposite of the debt code. And this holiness code was supposed to encourage the masses to lead holier lives, but in reality, it just allowed the Pharisees at the center to keep spirituality out of the reach of the common people and the peripheries. And again, the symbolic political nature of Jesus' meal with Levi and his friends would not have been lost on Mark's original audience. And it is certainly not lost on the Pharisees themselves in the story. One theologian that was quoted here put it this way: table fellowship is a guarantee of peace, trust, or brotherhood. Someone from Jesus' day would immediately understand the acceptance of the outcast into table fellowship with Jesus as an offer of salvation to guilty sinners and as the assurance of forgiveness. Already a marked man, Jesus continues to risk his standing in society, the credibility of his message, and his miracles to extend God's love and grace to those normally thought of as outside its reach, beyond the pale. Jesus' great love subverts rigid social boundaries between sinner and saved. Looking at Jesus' love in action from this political perspective is both inspiring and deeply troubling to me, because when I start to picture these stories in my own context, I often find myself in the exclusive center that Jesus is trying to deconstruct. It is me who is judging the sick or the poor for their plight, blaming their sins or life choices for the disadvantaged state that they're in. I play into systems that treat only the symptoms of their problems, rather than fully engaging them back into society, giving them dignity, and restoring their humanity. I rest on the promise of God's grace, and yet I consider myself to know who is forgiven and who is not. As I go through my day, watching the Daily Show, speaking to customers at the pub, or those who drunkenly stumble into my office on 20th Street and Avenue B, I foolishly consider myself in control of who is in and who is out. It's me who talks about the extensive breadth of God's plan of salvation, and yet I continue to judge those who do not seem to fit the mold, or who live in a way that I deem not holy enough for God's love. It is me who avoids association with those who might damage my reputation, refusing to meet them where they're at without condemnation or agenda. It is me in the empire, at a time in history where my race, my religion, my education, the wealth derived from exploitations of my colonial past, my dominant economic system in the world these things put me at the center in many ways. And it makes it hard for me to serve, to be taught by, but also to receive love like those in the peripheries. And this isn't to say that Jesus is against me just because of a position in a system that I was born into, but rather he's shown me what love can look like within that system. And I think it begins with an awareness of our position in it, with a consideration of the subtle ways that we exploit and exclude, the ways we allow injustice to flourish, the ways we're stingy with grace, and of how we refuse the generosity of God's love. I don't have any solutions or action plans for you tonight, but I think it starts with recognizing that it's actually us who need God's elaborate inclusivity. If it's me at the center, I'm at risk of being aligned against God's purposes, to be bypassed by his grace by refusing to recognize the wide and deep and radical love that he offers. The passage we began tonight with from Isaiah 42 talks about what I'm going to dub the political agenda of Advent. Because these themes we've looked at in Mark, the love we've seen in action in the Gospels, I think this is what Isaiah is talking about when he says that those who walk in darkness have seen a great light. This is the kind of love that he has illuminated for us. You can just put that back on the screens, Rob. I'm going to paraphrase. Jesus was sent to us as a baby to bring justice to the nations, not through a militaristic coup or by a successful war, but through nonviolence. Not shouting, but also not faltering or losing heart. And even those we aren't familiar with will be in on this plan. God created the earth with authority over the natural world, but also with a vested interest in us, his children. Jesus was sent to us to lead by example and as a symbol of this beautiful covenant between us and the Father. He was sent to give light to everyone in the world. He will open our eyes. He's healing us physically, socially, and spiritually. He came to set us free. I think Jesus wants to include us in this process, to bring justice to the poor, to extend his healing power to the peripheries, and it will cost us, as it did him, to minister to those outside the social and physical centers of our world. But I think the greater challenge is to deconstruct in ourselves, the church, our tight grasp on our modern codes of debt and purity and holiness that so offended Jesus in his day. And we too may come off as impure, blasphemers, those of low reputation, too lenient. I'll be honest, this kind of love seems extremely risky, and I'm afraid to get it wrong. But on the other hand, I can't imagine how much it must break God's heart to see his followers limit the reach of his grace, of his salvation, and of his love. Jesus came to undermine systems of exclusion that seek to constrain his radical love. He came to give us love and love for all. And that's what gives me joy and hope and peace. I think I can hear the angels sing, "There has come a child and a king. Peace upon the earth, because he will bring love for all."